I am officially declaring a national emergency.
Unprecedented times call for unprecedented actions.
Starting tomorrow, NBA play is suspended.
NCAA has canceled the men's and women's basketball tournaments.
Welcome to Managing the Crisis, brought to you by Core Image Studio.
The number of Americans filing claims for unemployment benefits has hit a record high.
There are fears that the Dow will drop and drop quickly.
The media giants are under pressure from a dramatic pullback in ad spending.
Now here's your host, the president of Barrett Sports Media, Jason Barrett.
Episode number 11 for those of you scoring at home. I'm Jason Barrett. Thanks for making time to listen to the Managing the Crisis podcast. It's been a blast doing these shows because it's allowed me to gain insight into a number of different areas of the media business. Hopefully in that process, it's helped you as well. I want to thank Core Image Studio. They're the ones who make this happen. They support everything we do at Barrett Sports Media. You can show your appreciation to Justin Dove by visiting coreimagestudio.com. And if you're a brand in need of imaging, get in touch with Justin. He does tremendous work. Today on the show, I'm excited to chat with David Scott. David is the first producer and correspondent to HBO's Real Sports with Bryant Gumbel, one of my favorite sports shows on television. The show has a brand new episode out tonight, April 28th at 10 o'clock Eastern. The feature that David is involved in is the one that caught my eye. It examines the role sports has played domestically and internationally in the spread of the coronavirus. Now, one of the key issues with that is we're all looking for answers to what happens next in the world of sports. But before we can move forward, it's important to understand where we've been and what we missed, because otherwise we're going to be dealing with a repeat occurrence of the situation we're currently in. I hear the president, Dr. Fauci, league owners, and commissioners all talking about bringing games back without fans, and it sounds fine, but is it realistic? If play starts and a few days later LeBron James, Mike Trout, or Aaron Rodgers came down with coronavirus, then what? If you're a Packers fan, you're probably saying, well, the Jordan Love era will begin sooner. But in all seriousness, what if it was an owner like Jerry Jones or the commissioner, Adam Silver, or a broadcaster calling the action like Jim Nantz? Then what? I want to see sports back, fans in the stands, hear the roar of the crowd, and see the media industry thriving just as you do. But if athletes are going to have their health potentially compromised playing in empty stadiums or arenas, then I have to wonder if we're making the right call, because there's no way to avoid human contact in professional sports, and there's more people needed to pull these events off than just the athletes themselves. I get it. You're home. You're stuck. You want to get back to some sense of normalcy. We all do. And at some point, we do have to take a chance and move forward. I just hope that when that time comes, the right call is made, because if we make the wrong choice, this thing could be way worse, and that is not what any of us need. Someone who's unfortunately seen the worst of this virus being located in New York is David Scott of HBO's Real Sports, and he takes some time to join me here on the Managing the Crisis podcast. David, it's a real pleasure having you here. Before I dive into the professional side, I want to begin with looking at how this pandemic has impacted you personally, given that you're located in the Bronx. What have these past 2 months been like in your world?
The speed with which the whole world changes, it's just really flabbergasting. And so, you know, I was thinking about, you know, the first week in March, we were still on the trains and buses here going to, in my case, Hudson Yards to the office. In the course of my regular commute, I probably come into contact with 5,000 people between the subway and the bus. And that's even before I get to the, you know, the enormous sprawling complex that is Hudson Yards. But New York is just it's a different scale. And there's a reason why it is now the worldwide epicenter of the pandemic. It's terrifying. We're trying to hunker down as much as possible. But, you know, even a trip to the pharmacy or the grocery store just feels really perilous. And that's before we try and explain to our children, you know, how it's possible that life just fell off a cliff all of a sudden. So we're counting our blessings. You know, we also live in rather small quarters in New York City, and they're not designed for all of us to be here at the same time, 24/7. But thanks for asking. We're holding up okay, and I hope you and yours are too.
Let's talk about the professional side, because the personal is tough enough, but then you've got this balance that you've got to walk with keeping yourself productive on a professional note. What's the last 2 months been like in the shoes of a producer and reporter?
You know, this is in some ways the greatest shock to my system. You know, my life is and the most interesting part of the job is travel. And so I'm on the road, you know, at least a couple times a month, could be to Ohio, could be to Japan. That's sort of my normal. And to go from that to, you know, I can't even go down the block. It's really just shocking. And then, you know, at a sort of larger, more important level, we had to do a lot of hard and smart thinking to figure out what our role is in this. You know, we don't play on the 24-hour news cycle. We're not doing breaking news coverage of the virus. It's very hard to justify the regular way we do production because it's not possible to social distance in it. And so we made a decision, you know, early on that we would not put our people and crews on the road and at risk, that we would not expose our interview subjects. And so we had to learn, you know, as everyone has in production, you know, this new sort of homebound way of doing it. And really this show was put together in our basements and living rooms. And so that was a steep learning curve. And for a show like ours, which is really not to you know, toot our own horns, but you know, our show is really about quality. We do 30 stories a year. We try and make them the definitive deep dives on the subject matter. There's not a lot of tolerance for low production values, and we've tried to figure out how to bring, you know, the essential DNA of real sports to a very different kind of production, and I'll leave it to you tonight at 10 o'clock to tell me if we succeed.
You know what's interesting with that is I think one of the advantages you guys have is that you're not at the mercy of the news cycle. Because you guys focus on storytelling and investigative journalism, you're able to do stories no matter what. You know, you just change your focus. That being said, the standard of excellence that people have come to know from real sports is certainly going to be expected when they put the television on tonight at 10 o'clock. And when you have to produce things from your living room or your kitchen table, that's certainly got to make it challenging and, you know, probably put a little extra stress on you, because you're going, how do I maintain the standard of what people expect when I don't have the tools around me or the ability to do what I typically do? So how do you do that?
It's an excellent point. We work with the best crews in the business. I don't sit here thinking about how to position lights and you know, what's the best mic to use, what's the best lens to use.
Right.
You know, none of that is my expertise. But I'm here in my basement alone, setting up lights, setting up microphones, trying to make sure that I remember to turn off the boiler before I start an interview. You know, begging my wife to come down and frame up the shot.
You know what's amazing about that, David? I have a dog, and every time I get ready to tape a podcast, he seems to want to be at the door, and he's got this, like, he breathes real heavy, and I have to now make sure that he's nowhere near the door. These are the things that people don't see just to put on a production.
Exactly. Somebody, you know, FedEx comes to deliver a package, dogs go nuts, or you know, we're here in the Bronx, you know, it's loud.
Boom, fire department's boom, driving down the street and the siren goes and you got to stop recording.
Exactly. So it has been a baptism by fire that I could have never expected. In fact, I'm not a native user of a lot of this technology. I'm a boomer. I'm in the tail end, but so none of this comes naturally or easy, but it's the price of admission for, you know, for laying on the air. And, you know, on the bright side, because it's such an extraordinary moment, it's a great opportunity for real sports to reinforce our role as the outlet that people turn to understand the intersection of sport and society. And that mission holds up, and it's been a privilege, frankly, to weigh in at such an important crossroads in the world.
Tonight at 10 o'clock, Real Sports on HBO. The program's got a heavy focus planned towards the impact on sports as a result of the coronavirus outbreak. Jim Nantz, Joe Buck, Mike Breen are part of a roundtable chat with Brian Gumbel. That should be great. Your piece, though, is the one that specifically got my attention. It's titled The March of COVID-19, and it focuses on how sports leagues and organizations played a role in the spread of this disease, both domestically and internationally. Without giving away all the answers to what we're going to see in the piece, what were some of the key takeaways you learned while researching the topic?
Well, really, we're exploring the unique epidemiology of live spectator sports in the context of a pandemic outbreak like coronavirus. Now, sports events are in fact, among the biggest regularly scheduled gatherings in the world.
Mm-hmm.
That alone makes them incredibly important in the context of a viral outbreak. But more than that, it's not just that they're gathering tens of thousands of people in close quarters on a regular basis all over the world. But those people are cheering and jeering and yelling and screaming and chanting and eating and drinking and high-fiving, all the things that make for ideal conditions for communicating disease. And so that's how, you know, for example, a single game can really move the needle of a pandemic by setting the fire of contagion that then can be carried far and wide from a single event. That's what we learned from the so-called Game Zero played in Milan on February 19th. And that's what we fail to learn in applying those principles to pro sports in America when public health authorities began imploring that large gatherings be disbanded in the first week in March. And so we trace the major sports teams and leagues who resisted the call by public authorities to stand down for fear of inadvertently spreading the virus. And there are too many examples of it to the point where every single epidemiologist we talk to has no doubt that those games that were played in the first and second weeks of March actually moved the needle in terms of adding cases and human suffering and even deaths to the toll.
Jesus. I mean, you think about it, you're right. I mean, we didn't have sports shut down till the middle of the month, and this was starting in December and January, so you're probably looking at January and February while it's ramping up, not to mention those first 2 weeks in March, which is nuts. And you know what makes me wonder, David, is you hear so much talk right now from these leagues and from, you know, the president has put together a task force of sports commissioners and owners to talk about returning sports to normal activity without fans. And then Dr. Fauci has said he's on board with it. I mean, from when you're talking to all these folks about what's already transpired, is there optimism that this could actually become something where sports is back in a month or two without people getting sick? Because I'm having a hard time seeing that, but so many seem to be thinking that's possible. I just don't know how you get 30 teams with 25 players per team, coaches, front office, hotel staff, cooks, all these people that are needed just to pull off live sports. But look, I'm not Dr. Fauci, and he seems to think that it can be done. So what do you hear back when you talk to folks about that?
It's interesting. I mean, first, you know, Game Zero happened on February 19th. As you say, there's no doubt that the virus was already circulating even in the months before that, January and December. To be fair, there was a period of time where it could not have been foreseen. We're focusing on the period of time starting in early March in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
where it could certainly have been foreseen. And in fact, if leagues didn't know what to do, at that point they were being told what to do by credible public health authorities really all over the country, local authorities, county authorities, state authorities, and federal authorities. And so, you know, we're focusing on this period of time is critical period of time in the early stages of the pandemic here in March. I know that as to the reopening, the eventually reopening or return to sports, I know that the CDC has issued guidelines now for all of society to sort of try and govern this process of returning. There's so much political pressure to it. There's so much economic pressure to it.
Mm-hmm.
It will be so easy to jump the shark here and make decisions that frankly outpace the science. CDC is now saying that if you have, you know, that one of the requirements is that you have to have 14 days of steady decline in new cases. That seems like a smart measure. You know, will the bosses of sport now start paying more attention to what public health authorities are saying and advising amidst all the economic pressure to get business up and running again? You probably know that the UFC is planning to hold fight cards in Florida in early May,
yep.
May 9th, without fans, but even still in a sport in which snot and spit and blood is traded between fighters and beyond. And as you point out, even without the fans, when you think about all the people that are required to put on a major live spectator sports event, you probably get to the hundreds without even a single fan being in the house.
Right.
Between the production staff and the athletes and their trainers and coaches and medical staff and all the different roles that are essential to that level of event production. So I'm worried. I'm worried because we've already seen there has been resistance to doing what public health authorities have advised. There's all this pent-up pressure. It's actually mounting pent-up pressure from an economic perspective. And again, it would just be so easy to get ahead of the science here in a way that actually prolongs a sustainable return to sports or business more generally.
What's hard is both of us work in the media industry, and you see the advertising industry has been gutted in the last 2 months. You see if there are no live events, that means leagues can't play, which means networks can't broadcast, which means leagues are probably not going to get the money from networks that they're accustomed to getting, which means athletes don't make the same amount of money. So you can see why everybody wants to get back to work, because otherwise a lot of people are going to be drastically impacted. That being said, we all have this bigger focus, which is let's do it the right way. Let's make sure we're safe, because our health and our families come before any job. As you look ahead, if this thing continues to go on, how do you see this affecting what you do and furthermore real sports and what you guys focus on from a content standpoint? Because you can tell so many stories, but if this is the one that's dominating the landscape, I'm sure it's probably going to put some more pressure to do more of this kind of reporting. No,
absolutely. And we want to, you know, we very much see the show as one that's designed precisely for these big stories that connect society and sport, you know, in ways that are important. And so I've no doubt that we'll be staying on this. We'll be staying on this beat. What it will look like is very hard to tell. It's hard for me to imagine, you know, being restricted to basement interviews for the next several months, but it is entirely possible.
Right.
I think the panel gets into it and sort of reckons with the question of, you know, we have these great sports broadcasters sitting down with Brian Gumbel, and they're facing the prospect that 2020 could come and go without their voices being heard in the broadcast.
Mm-hmm.
There's a recognition that you know, we're on uncharted territory, and I just hope that we can keep the scientists at the center of the decision making. Keep the science at the center of the decision making. I think the sports world and the whole world will be better off if we can manage that.
Before I let you run, I've got to throw one last one by you. You've been part of,
yes,
one of my favorite shows on television, so I've got to ask, the one story you've worked on that you're most proud of and the one you haven't told that you're chomping at the bit to do?
Good, great question. Well, I should point out this show tonight is our 25th anniversary show.
Congrats!
Real Sports Zone has been on the air for 25 years now, and you know, while we have evolved in many ways, the core of the show is the same. You know, there's still no music, there's still no fancy graphics. It's really about the reporting and the storytelling. For me personally, it's really hard to single out one story. You know, I've been lucky to be a part of many that have been well recognized. I guess you know, there's one that stands out to me just because it was the kind of story that only Real Sports would have done, and that was our trip to Chechnya in 2017, where we sat down with the head of the Chechen Republic, the dictator Ramzan Kadyrov, who at the time was developing a serious profile in professional MMA while he was purging his republic of gay men and women in a ruthless way. That one stands out to me because, you know, to me, the ultimate test is, you know, real sports groups should be doing the pieces that no one else can or will do. And then, man, there's so many that that are still untold. We've been working for years to try and tell the story of baseball in Venezuela amidst the collapse of that dystopian society and regime. We were hoping to follow the Olympic story this year, the cursed Tokyo 2020 Games, beset by scandal, by corruption, by the fallout from literally the fallout from a nuclear disaster in Fukushima.
Mm-hmm.
The IOC actually is another interesting case of allowing their process, their events to go on, particularly qualifying events, straight through the middle of March. Probably the most globalized, almost by definition, of all sports league, the biggest, the richest, and they were gathering athletes by the thousands at these qualifying events, bringing them from scores of countries, and then sending them back. After holding trials in close contact sports like boxing and wrestling and taekwondo, you know, there are still so many important stories just about this pandemic to do from a, you know, through the lens of sport. If there's a silver lining in any of this for us, for the show, it's again to reinforce our role as the best place to come to understand the meaning of sport and society, the intersection of sport and society, and we relish the chance to do it, whether it's, you know, on the road or from our basements.
Well, congrats on 25 years. That's an outstanding feat. The show is tremendous. Look forward to it. And it's tonight, 10 o'clock Eastern. It's going to be really exciting and very interesting, I'm sure. You guys do fantastic work, David. I want to thank you for the time today.
Jason, I really appreciate you having us on, and let's keep in touch.